It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast this also on the weekend and then right after our Monday 12 noon news as well. David also is a PBS television correspondent. He reports on ethics and belief, and he's got a terrific website, his own website, which is themediabeat.us, and we'll bring David in right now. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be with you again, reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City.
And what we have to kick off this morning that I'd like to get your feelings are, once again, we've lived through another Hamas Israeli conflict over, which really ended with both sides in the ceasefire claiming victory, but both sides also not really recognizing the real losers in this whole thing. We're not Hamas or Israel. It's the Palestinian people that seem to always get caught in this crossfire.
Sure. 11 days of battering. Very unequal, what in the military field is called asymmetric warfare. And clearly, while many people were killed, many more injured, it's clear the imbalance involved here. Palestinians always come off worse than these altercations between the very powerful and, of course, a force like Hamas, which exploits its very weakness and does things like sending out those thousands and thousands of rockets without a particularly sophisticated guided weapon system, which is, of course, what the Israelis do have. And the Israelis do have this extraordinary thing that they call the Iron Dome to protect themselves against fairly primitive weaponry like Hamas have. And, great harm is inflicted on both sides, it has to be said, but the imbalance in force comes out very clearly in the casualty figures that show that many more Palestinians were killed than Israelis. Not that it means anything except that one of these two parties is extremely powerful and the other one isn't so powerful. But it doesn't mean that they're powerless. Hamas has a grip on that particular part of the Palestinian territory. We mustn't forget there are all the Palestinians living in Israel itself and, of course, on the occupied West Bank, where they're represented not by Hamas but by the more traditional Palestinian mouthpiece, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It's easy and a little glib for journalists to describe the PLO as moderate in comparison to Hamas. That's not the best adjective to use, I don't think. But they are a different kind of organization. They're secular. They don't have the jihadist element that Hamas has. And the situation overall has been set to a boil by this event, as always happens when things get when disputes get weaponized. They were already very nasty with the protests in the streets getting very violent, and especially with the Israelis' way of handling the protests in the streets. And then, of course, the escalation that it led to was one of those periods, as you say, that do recur when you have, in essence, outright warfare. And now we have, mercifully, a ceasefire which is held, or is holding so far. But, of course, that can't be the end of the matter, because none of these ceasefires can hold for any length of time unless things start to happen on a diplomatic front. And that's what's being pushed for. It's interesting to see the Biden administration's response to this all of this, keeping to its traditional American position of saying that Israel is a strong ally and perfectly not perfectly at liberty, but certainly has the perfect right to do all it has to do to protect its own security. But at the same time, President Biden had six conversations with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's clinging on to power in all of this, and evidently, from all the briefing that journalists have been given about these calls, the phone calls between the two leaders, Biden just increased the pressure over the 11 days and insisted more increasingly strongly towards yesterday that the military aggression into Gaza should be de-escalated and a ceasefire should be implemented. And that's where we are now. But where it takes us is, of course, with the Middle East question, still a very, very open affair. Is the diplomacy going to work or not? There's a lot of people working to ensure that it does, and we just need to keep a wary eye on it from now on.
Yeah, it's one of the examples of the difference in foreign policy between the former president and this administration. Is there is, whether you agree with the policy or not, there is a formulation of a definite foreign policy. It's not shoot from the hip.
That's right. It's considered, I think is a good word for the American the current American administration's approach. Biden is being almost as painstaking about every decision he makes as his former boss, President Obama, was. It's annoying to many people when they'd like to see a firmer and faster response from him, but it's not what he gives. And a long phone call that he had with a New York Times columnist this last week, I think Biden laid out pretty clearly what his approach in general to governing is, which is to be very considered about it. And in this case, there was no shooting from the hip. There was no knee-jerk response that said Israel's in the right, although that was the backdrop to our position, because the American position, I should say, because that always has been the case, that the Israelis get something of a pass internationally. What is said in the White House is very different from what is said, for instance, in the United Nations General Assembly. The world at large takes a different view, but while the backdrop is that America and Israel are very close allies, the Biden approach is to say, well, yes, that's the case, but you've also got to behave in ways that can allow for a peaceful settlement to still be on the table at the end of however long this battering takes place. And it seemed to take 11 days for that to happen, an eternity, of course. It should never have been that long. No conflict should be set in place for any length of time, of course. It needs to be nipped in the bud as soon as possible. In this case, as soon as possible, turn out to be those whole 11 days. But Biden's treading very carefully, and I think it's probably to the administration's credit that he is. Could still operate out well outside Americans' control. America's position in the Middle East is weakened, in fact, by 4 years of Trump and the ever closer association with Israel. America is finding it very difficult to be seen as anything like an honest broker in the middle of this dispute. That's not what they are. But with Egypt's help, they were able to exert the kind of pressure which brought Netanyahu back from the brink and into the realm of, we hope, some kind of negotiating posture again.
All right. Of course, this is the Media Beat with David Tarachuk, and we normally have a fanfare, but we're going to do something a little different today, right, David?
A different sound effect, I'm afraid, for a very different kind of story.
All right, and what we'll do is we'll head to that sound effect right now and take it from there.
Yeah, that's the sound of the trombone doing the what I think is traditionally called the sad trombone sound, the wah-wah sound of many movies and many pieces of orchestral music too. I don't want to be glib about it, but it's to mark a journalistic event which is sad and bad. I think it's one of the most lamentable pieces of journalism which has been exposed to the world this week over the Atlantic in my old home country of Britain, and the journalistic organization which I think the world at large has good cause to have admired for many decades, a century or more now, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. As you know, I have no dog in this fight, as it were. I've never really worked for the BBC except for some freelance contributions at times. I've always been on the other side of the rivalry in Britain. I worked for commercial television there for many years. But the BBC is something, an institution I do admire, and its standards are remarkable. In a bad world, it has often stood out like a beacon. A bright light in the naughty world is the old phrase. But in this case, the infamous now case of the so-called scoop interview way back a quarter of a century ago, this is how deeply embedded this offense is. There was a scoop interview which many in the across the world as a whole will remember, a so-called scoop with Princess Diana, in which she came out and complained about her marriage being contaminated by adultery. Her famous phrase was that there are three people in this marriage of ours, referring to her marriage to Prince Charles, the heir to the throne, meaning, of course, that Charles's mistress, Lady Camilla, I'm giving her a ladydom here, and I shouldn't do that, although she now has a title because she is now Prince Charles's official consort, and now that Princess Diana is long dead, of course. Princess Diana had this almost mythic position, gained it, sad to say, mainly through her terrible death. But she was already possibly one of the most famous women in the world when a BBC reporter called Martin Bashir persuaded her to give this interview. And the way that he did that is a piece of journalistic chicanery, which has just been exposed after a long and thorough investigation by a former Supreme Court justice in Britain, Lord Dyson. And it's horrific to hear the details. Some of them have been well known for a quarter of a century, but the worst part of it, not just that Martin Bashir himself was a con man and went to extraordinary lengths to con the princess into doing this interview, including, by the way, something which sends a tremor of horror through television journalists like myself. He got a graphic artist working for him on the television program he worked at to mock up a fake bank account to show Princess Diana, to convince her that one of her staff was receiving payments from other media people, not the BBC, but other people, the tabloids in particular, was the point of Bashir's falsehood. He was trying to persuade the princess that people within her own staff were leaking material about her, harmful material about her, to the tabloids, and therefore she should give him at the BBC, the respectable journalist organization, the interview that she eventually agreed to give. And that was his method, appalling though it was. He got away with it at the time, and he got away with it afterwards in another sense, too. The BBC instituted an investigation because, as I say, it was known that he had this capability to falsify material and get his scoops, and he did this in other instances too, other stories too, getting his so-called scoops by false pretenses. And the investigation conducted at the time by the man who at the time was the was in charge of all news at the BBC, a man called Tony Hall, essentially cleared him. And it's taken this long, 26 years, for the truth finally to come out. And I have to say that along the way, Bashir left the BBC, came to the United States, got a job with MSNBC, had a sort of had a time in New York that I just want to discreetly draw a veil across. But in the course of that time in America, he finally blotted his copybook so many times, and with another public figure, Sarah Palin in this case, he had to leave. And he went back to the BBC, and that same Mr. Tony Hall, who by now was the overall director general of the entire BBC, hired him back again. And this time, he was hired to be the reporter on the area of religion. And that sends a kind of tremor of distress through me, because as you tell listeners every week, that's my beat too. In Britain, I was in charge of programs about religion and about belief and ethics. And since 2012 in this country, for my colleagues at the BBC public broadcasting system, that's my brief again, ethics and belief. And Martin Bashir became the BBC's man on religion, and of course that embraces ethics too. It's a sad, egregious, horrific, appalling story, and I want to register that thank goodness, at long last, it's been exposed. And of course, you know, this will become a fodder for people to attack the BBC, not justified, the overall attack, I mean. The BBC is not, it comes off badly in this instance, but it's not a bad journalistic organization altogether. It's in fact amongst our best. But part of being the best is to, you know, is to root out those instances where we go wrong and where we go bad. And this is one very horrific case of the BBC going bad in the person of one individual with a value system that I can only decry.
And when you think about the damage it caused to the family, when I say the family, the sons and the family itself, it makes it even more tragic.
Sure, the impact was sensational, which is what Bashir wanted, and of course, the older of the two princes who are her sons. Made a point that it contributed to the troubling mixture of fear and paranoia that their mother suffered in those last years of her life, and it's not a stretch to say that it contributed to the tragic end that Princess Diana's life did have. Not that it caused it. But it certainly built up that you will remember, I'm sure, that strange atmosphere of hostility between the princess and the rest of the establishment royal family, and the fear and paranoia, as her son Prince William said yesterday, was palpable. And of course, you can assign much of that to the deviousness of this one reporter who told her untruths and backed them up with false evidence in order to increase her paranoia for his own professional selfish ends.
Now, do we have anything to celebrate in
Well, thank goodness. I want to remedy the egregiousness that and go back to our familiar fanfare sound, shall we?
Sure.
Good good news for journalism this week in that in one particular instance. I think it's worth singling out public broadcasters on this side of the water. The nearest equivalent we have in the United States to the BBC is the PBS network, of course, a public broadcasting system. And my colleagues there at Frontline Program have done a sterling piece of work this week devoted to our hospital system. It's disturbing, it's saddening, but the journalism is excellent, and that's why I want to use the fanfare of excellence to honor it. It's it was this week's Frontline. Actually, it was a joint venture by PBS and NPR as well, so public broadcasting across the whole remit, both audio and video, deserves credit here. It was contrasting the fate of safety net hospitals, you know, the public hospitals that are set up as a public service and are funded publicly to do that, contrasting them with the fate of for-profit hospitals during this terrible year for the health industry of COVID. The fact that safety net hospitals are now almost at the point of destruction, they've been tested to destruction almost by the stresses and strains of dealing with COVID, while at the same time, while they are struggling to survive, at the same time, for-profit hospitals have done just what their name suggests. They have profited. It's an extraordinary thing, but one of the biggest for-profit hospital groups in the country has, and this is not untypical, experienced a profit increase over the COVID year of 38%. It's quite extraordinary. And meanwhile, because all sorts of ironies, horrific ironies that come out of America's weird and far from wonderful healthcare system, the emergency assistance that went to hospitals from the government ended up rescuing, if that's the right word. That was the word that was used in the legislation. Rescue funds. Rescue funds went to hospitals in direct proportion to the losses they were experiencing. And of course, if you're a very big and very well-funded hospital, you can argue that your losses are huge, and indeed they were. But the injection of cash from the government went first to these big losers, only temporarily losing, of course. But the crazy mathematics of all this is that more money went to the richer hospitals because their losses looked bigger on paper, and very by comparison, very little help went to the hospitals that really needed it. So you end up with this picture now, as I say, of all the safety net hospitals, the vast majority of the safety net hospitals suffering and being on the very edge of survival, and ready pickings indeed for those hospitals and those business people on the fringes of the business who want to swoop in and buy them up and, guess what, turn them into for-profit hospitals. Another example, I think, of COVID illustrating the craziness and the crying need for reform overall in the United States health system, if you can even call it a system.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing I've always said, and I've experienced this. The health care in the United States is second to none. The access to health care in the United States is at the bottom of the rung. And I years ago, I think it was 7 or 8 years ago, I went through a series of 3 to 4 important surgeries on my legs and my feet at the Hospital for Special Surgery. And when I received the bill, it was quite frightening, and I called up and I said, yeah, maybe you're going to need some sort of payment plan for life, and they said to me, no, just send us your financial records, and we'll. So I sent my financial records in. I'm not a poor person, I'm not a wealthy person, but I sent my financial records in, and reducing the hospital bill by almost at the hospital almost 80%. because of my economic situation. But unfortunately,
for-profit hospitals rake in a lot of money because they can. Yeah. They can charge whatever they like because of our crazy system. And of course, insurance policies on the whole will enable them to do that.
And I'm glad that somebody did an investigation into that because we all knew that in the first COVID-19 relief fund, big companies and stockbrokers and everything were the ones that got the brunt of the money the first time around for the exact same reason.
So. Yeah, and you say, well, the health provision, if you like, or the technology and the skills are second to none, but the access is not. Is a very good way of summing up the problem. And of course, the end result of that is that it doesn't mean that the country's health is better as a result of a superior set of skills and technologies. Indeed, the result of all of this is that in certain areas, like for instance maternal mortality and early life mortality is high, and overall life expectancy is poorer than most advanced societies in the world, and that's an appalling record for a country as rich and as well resourced in terms of skills and technologies as America is. They may have the best doctors in the world, but as you say, they have something like the worst health record for its own people in many regards.
Well, that is a look at the media beat. Next week, we'll talk a little bit about the U.S. Senate and the attack on the Capitol.
Indeed.
All
right. More to come.
David, thank you very much. Have a good weekend, and we'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. You can find his website, themediabeat.us. You can also find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.